Fred Film Radio, Venice Film Festival, Italy.
Fred Film Radio, this is Chiara Nicoletti from the 71st Venice International Film Festival. Today I'm with Scott Hayes and Jacopo Loeb, actors in the new film by James Franco, The Sound of the Fury, screening here out of competition. So, how many times have you and James worked together?
I don't know. Well, over a decade we've done stuff together. I mean, we've known each other since well over a decade now as friends, and we've done plays and film and plays for charity and other films and art exhibit, you know, things. We've done numerous things together over the years. I'd have to add it up. It'd take a minute to figure it out, but it's been a lot.
And how did you meet him?
I met James in, I think it might have been near 2000. I don't know. Whenever he did the James Dean movie, because he saw me in a play that I did at Stella Adler. I was doing a play in Hollywood, and he came, and we in the back parking lot where they hold the Oscars now. That wasn't even built. It was a field. And he just came up to me, and he said, "I really love your performance." And I said, I loved you in the James Dean movie. I just watched him. And after that, we stayed connected, and we ended up going to the same acting school and had a lot of mutual friends, and we've just grown really close over the years.
Since you also have been working with James for two films now, so how do you structure your work with him? For example, in this film, did you read the novel? Did you work with him on how to develop your characters?
I mean, it's the kind of thing where, you know, at some point James will, like, call me or tell me on whatever project we're working on, "I want you to read this book." You know, I remember we were working on Bukowski, and he said, "Well, I want you to go ahead and read Sound and the Fury." And I had never read any Faulkner before, which is like a sacrilegious American, never read Faulkner. But I ended up reading Sound and the Fury, and I was immediately really drawn to Quentin. And I had several months for this particular project to prepare, because he's off doing other things, and then when we get together, it's really quick, knock it out really quick.
I catch wind of projects that are in the works, books that are optioned. There's certain books that we're looking at doing, certain authors that have written certain things, so it just depends. Sometimes things happen in a very quick way, or sometimes they don't with him. With this one, I was here last year with Child of God, and I knew that we started filming this movie 5 days after this festival wrapped. So while I was here at this festival this time, last year for Child of God, I was reading Sound of the Fury in Venice last year, preparing. Because I knew I had like 5 days to get into it. Yeah, I came straight from this festival and basically L.A. for a day or two and then moved to Mississippi. But it's different. Everyone's different. You know, sometimes with Child of God, I had a lot of time to prepare, and we knew about that a long time. Sometimes the things align, and it's kind of like, oh, we're shooting this in October. So it just varies project to project on how long you know before we start on them.
So this was never the intention to do As I Lay Dying and The Sound of the Fury from the start, I mean.
I think that I can only speak on his behalf. I mean, I know that he loved As I Lay Dying in high school, and he loved that. It was one of his favorite novels, and I think he likes challenges, and people have said this is a very hard movie to adapt into a film. So I think that probably spurred James into saying, well, we're going to give it a good run and give it a, you know.
Yeah, I think he really wanted another piece of Faulkner, you know, after doing As I Lay. It sounded like, I wasn't in that one, but it sounded like it was a really amazing experience for everyone involved artistically and personally, and it seemed like James was pretty, like, ready to jump into more Faulkner stuff.
How does he act when he becomes a director?
James is the best because he's an actor as well. So he gives you the freedom to explore things and try things and do the work as an actor. And he understands the actor's situation really well. So if you're struggling with something, or he just has your back in ways that other directors who don't understand the process of an actor would. So you're kind of teed up from the start for success to explore and try things.
He directs with a lot of space. You know, he doesn't give you a lot of really stupid notes about how to turn your head or how to say a line. Really lets you do your thing. And usually when you ask him how's it going, he's like, "It's good." You know, he's very free, sort of.
I was thinking, I haven't read the Faulkner novel, so everything I got it from the film yesterday. So that's, I had to start with that because, and so my opinion of your two characters is that they're both obsessed or kind of in love with their sister in a different way. He has a, somehow, you can say hate, but it's not hate, it's a different relationship, and you're all, well, we can say, like, it's, I was telling my colleague when I came out, I said, if a person came out in the screening right when they're fighting after she has seen him with a girl, you would tell that they're a couple fighting. So you would never tell that they're brothers and sisters. So I don't know if that feeling that I have about your two characters is the right feeling I should have from the film. It is something that Faulkner expressed or just something that you added?
I think that that's certainly a major sort of component of the book. In fact, you could maybe argue that, like, the book, James was saying this earlier actually, like, the book is about three brothers staring up at their sisters like muddy underwear as she climbs a tree, which is an image that Faulkner, he saw his kids do that, and then that's what inspired the book. But yeah, I think it's very much that, and it's about three very specific perspectives and relationships towards this kind of magnificent, you know, young girl.
Yeah, from Jason's perspective, is there's an obsession that Benji has, which Caddy represents something to his character, which is, James will answer that when you guys talk to him. Obviously, there's something with Quentin. For me, I had huge ambitions that maybe didn't come very clear that it is in the novel, that I didn't get to be what I wanted to be because of what happened with her. She destroyed my plan and my dream. So it's deep resentment that I have towards my sister. So is it hatred? Yes. She screwed up my whole plan for my life. So I think it's a fair thing to say that she impacts, she represents a lot for other characters, and she really, not represents me, she represents the dying of, like, trying to get out of our crumbling family. Like, I wouldn't be working in this store if I would have been in the bank.
Well, basically, Caddy is more of a source of frustration more than love, in a way, for the three brothers.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, she's sort of the source of all of the drama, I think.
And I think that as a mechanism of story, from a novel standpoint, you need that somewhere. Because Benji's so far over here, and then there's this storyline, and then there's this storyline, and there's Quentin at Harvard, and there's, like, all these storylines, and Caddy's kind of a glue that kind of keeps everybody connected in sort of a family, so you can kind of tie in, oh, Quentin isn't far removed from Jason, even though I don't really have many, I don't even know if we have any scenes together. No, so we're brothers, but we don't have any scenes together. I'm just trying to remember because it's so.
Just have it when you're children, so not actually.
Yeah, so Caddy kind of, I think, serves as a Faulkner used as a mechanism to tie the family together. And frustration of love and dreams are all there, yeah.
How was working with a director who not only plays in the field, but plays that kind of character, in this case, Benji?
I mean, I think it's great. You know, I you got to realize, like, I just came off of a movie where I was crazier than Benji. You know, I just did that, you know. So I, and then, you know, you look at Tim. Tim had a lot of that going on in As He Lay Dying. Did you see As He Lay Dying? So, yeah, Tim's whole thing is very hard to understand and kind of crazy. So it's like, you know, it's actually almost better in a way with Benji, because picture Mel Gibson in Braveheart. Right, because he directed that, but he's in your face screaming. You got to really observe James. So it was fascinating, and it was a testimony to him as an actor to be able to step into Benji and then step behind the camera. And I think that if you really look at it, if people really examine how hard that is, it's a huge success.
It did something, I can speak for myself, that getting on set in Mississippi and seeing James like that on the first day of shooting, it did something to me. I mean, because it was not the James that I knew, you understand. I think his performance created a feeling on set, and I think it kind of became like a, what's the word? It offset everything in this really interesting way where we all were sort of like, oh, we're doing this, like, we're doing this movie, like, to see how committed he was to it. It's pretty amazing to watch him go back and forth. Oftentimes he would, you know, I have like many memories watching him perform a scene fully as Benji and, you know, instantaneously sort of come out and give directions as if somehow he's doing both at the same time, and then like on a dime just completely back into character. It was awesome to watch. It really was. It was like a blessing.
Thank you, Scott Eight and Jacob Loeb, for being here with us on Fright Free Radio. And this is Chiara Nicoletti from the Venice International Film Festival for Fred, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.